Hello, it's John Dennis on Friday, December the 5th. Today, at the end of a bad week for Jackie Smith, the Home Secretary is forced to consider how to amend the police DNA database after a ruling from the European Court of Human Rights.
As a result of the decision, the UK will have to amend the law to make it compatible.
The Bank of England cuts interest rates to the lowest level ever, and there's likely to be more to come. But will consumers benefit?
I don't see these rate cuts being passed on in full by any stretch of the imagination, despite what the government may say.
And the mother of 9-year-old Shannon Matthews is beginning a jail sentence today for kidnapping her own daughter.
On the 19th of February, Shannon Matthews was reported missing by the one person that she should have been able to trust above all others, her own mother, Karen Matthews. Karen Matthews is pure evil. She started deceiving those closest to her from the very moment that Shannon was kidnapped.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
Before we hear about any of that, let's have the news headlines and the papers from Sandy Waugh.
In Canada, the Governor-General's agreed to suspend Parliament for a month. The Prime Minister, Stephen Carter, argued that he needed more time to form a plan to save the economy. But opposition parties say that he's trying to avoid a confidence vote that would have brought down his government. They say his economic plan provided no stimulus for business. In the USA, the heads of the three big car makers face a second day of questioning in Congress, this time by a Financial Services Committee. They and their supporters have argued that if they fail, it'll throw the whole economy from recession into depression. But they've been criticised for increasing their demands from $25 to $34 billion. The sick state of the car market has led to Japanese company Honda to put its Formula One racing team up for sale. The company says that if it doesn't find a buyer within 2 months, it'll close the team down. Honda's already announced it's closing its British factory in Swindon for 2 months. In the Damien Green affair, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, Nick Clegg, says his party will boycott the committee to investigate the police search of Green's office in the House of Commons. Nick Clegg says the Speaker's committee should not have a Labour majority, which has neutered it. The Conservatives are also complaining the committee will not meet for months until after the police investigation is finished. Britain's banks are refusing to pass on the whole interest cut to mortgage customers, though the Bank of England cut its rate by 1 percentage point. The Royal Bank of Scotland and the Halifax said they would only trim a quarter point off mortgages in some cases. MPs are pointing out the banks have themselves been bailed out by the government. In football, it was a weak night for English clubs in the UEFA Cup. Portsmouth go out after losing to Wolfsburg 3-2. The winning goal came after a mistake by keeper David James. Aston Villa do get into the knockout stage on previous results, in spite of losing to Zelina 2-1. The veteran presenter of the Eurovision Song Contest for 35 years, Sir Terry Wogan, has had enough. He's handing over to Graham Norton because he says it is no longer a music contest. In the papers, The Guardian and The Telegraph focus on the way the banks won't pass on the interest rate cut. The Telegraph says Britain's biggest banks defied Gordon Brown last night. The Guardian says that the bailed-out high street banks risk the wrath of the government. The Financial Times and The Times join in with the commentary that the recession continues to deepen. The Independent asks if the authorities are now running out of ammunition after the pound still slumped and job losses are soaring. The Mail says that savers are thrown to the wolves by the Bank of England slashing its interest rates. It says savers are the forgotten losers. On the sports pages, many versions of Roy Keane's resignation from Sunderland Football Club. Several say that he did it by text message, which is a sign of how withdrawn he's become recently. But The Guardian quotes Chairman Niall Quinn saying that it was still amicable. But The Mirror and The Sun are already looking for the replacement. Sam Allardyce and Gordon Strachan are the names they choose. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
Holding the DNA of innocent people violates their human rights. That was what the European Court of Human Rights ruled yesterday. The case was brought by two Sheffield men who asked that their DNA records be destroyed. It means that nearly a million people who've committed no crime could now have their records removed from the National DNA database. Our legal affairs correspondent, Afua Hirsch, explains why the court in Strasbourg made the ruling.
What the court said yesterday is that although it is useful for solving crime, obviously, to have DNA data stored on a database, that system must be proportionate. And because it naturally involves an invasion of privacy, which is contrary to the European Convention on Human Rights, any interference with privacy has to be necessary for the purposes of solving crime. Now, the system that we have in the UK goes much further than what the court thinks is actually necessary, because we don't just keep the data of people who are any longer suspected of crime. Many people who've never been convicted or even charged have their details stored. And the court said that that goes too far in invading privacy, and it's not directly related to solving crime.
Has the British government got a right to appeal against this decision?
No, the decision that was made yesterday was made by the Grand Chamber of the European Court of Human Rights, which is basically its most heavyweight judicial panel, 17 judges, and it's the absolute final court. There's no appeal whatsoever. So as a result of the decision, the UK will have to amend the law to make it compatible.
Why? I mean, this case has been considered by various legal authorities in Britain, including the Law Lords. Why didn't they reach a similar decision to the European Court of Human Rights?
It's interesting if you look at the decision of the House of Lords, because they agreed that there was an interference with the right to privacy by having your details stored on the database. But they were so impressed by the potential of this data to solve crime that they said that it was a necessary intrusion of privacy. What the lawyers who appealed this to the European Court argued was that the House of Lords hadn't grappled sufficiently with the figures and with some of the history as to how this data has been used. There is quite patchy evidence as to how useful it is to have this much data to solve crime. And actually, statistics from the last year from the Home Office show that only 40% of convicted criminals actually do have their DNA on the database. So actually how useful it is for solving crime is something that's still under discussion. But clearly the House of Lords took a different view and thought that just solving a few crimes is enough of a justification for having such a large database.
Has Britain got a cavalier attitude towards civil rights?
In this respect, definitely. Because if you look at the system that's been working in England and Wales, it goes way beyond any other system anywhere in the world. Other major jurisdictions, each state in America has its own system, but none of them compare to ours. The same with the states in Australia, other European countries. Either they take or keep less data, or they destroy it when it's no longer needed for a specific investigation. And on top of that, they have much stricter safeguards as to how the data can be used. In this country, it's available through the Police National Computer, which means that insurance companies, other private companies, research institutions, they all have access to people's private DNA, including their history, their ethnic background, health problems, things that are considered in most countries very sensitive and private. So the fact that we have had such a far-reaching system here does raise questions about our attitude towards private information.
Afua Hirsch. Well, the Home Secretary, Jackie Smith, says she's disappointed with the court's decision and the government is now considering its response. Well, what are the government's options? Alan Travis is our Home Affairs editor.
It's a devastating ruling for Jackie Smith, the Home Secretary. Another bit of bad news for her in this wonderful week. For her, it means that she's going to have to convene a working group to sit down and come up by next March with a response, which to come in terms and comply with the terms of this judgment by all the, I think it's 17 judges sitting in Strasbourg, unanimous decision. I suspect that their first instinct is to not want to implement it in its entirety. Before this judgment, the government Home Office had made clear that they were in the market for extending these powers. That already 850,000 people have their fingerprints, DNA samples on the database of people who have not been convicted of any criminal offence, who've been arrested by the police, questioned by the police. And the current power allows them to have those DNA samples held there if the offence in connection with which they were taken is an imprisonable offence, what the police call a recordable offence, and the Home Office want to extend it to non-recordable offences, which would have seen DNA samples taken for offences as low as littering. So they're going to have to big moment pause for thought. Now, across Europe, this has implications because it's not just in Britain that will be applicable to. In France, for example, I understand at the moment they keep everyone's fingerprints and DNA samples for 25 years. So they may well have to rethink that again. And the only country, I think, which doesn't, big countries, Germany, who I think destroy immediately anyone's fingerprints and DNA samples taken if their the police investigation comes to an end without a conviction.
Are there any cases that would not have been solved had the police not had access to DNA of innocent people?
Well, the Association of Chief Police Officers yesterday afternoon issued a statement in which they claimed from a sample of 200,000 DNA cases on the database who were taken from people who hadn't been convicted, they were the records linked to more than 114 murders and 116 rapes. But it's impossible to know whether that was at the price of out of about 850,000 samples, whether that's an acceptable price to pay or not.
Alan Travis, and you can have your say on this issue by going to Comment is Free, where Henry Porter has written a piece. Also on The Guardian's website today, Robert Fox on how vulnerable London might be to a Mumbai-style terror attack. That's at guardian.co.uk/terrorism. Canada's government may be about to fall. Heather Malik explains why you should care about that at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. And Rabbi Jonathan Romaine on why faith schools should end selection by religion. guardian.co.uk/education. The Bank of England cut the cost of borrowing yesterday from 3% to 2%. That's the lowest interest rates have been since 1951. Yesterday's move follows last month's record 1.5 percentage point cut. Larry Elliott, our economics editor, says it was a bold decision by the bank, but widely expected.
Yes, I think it was fully priced into the market that the bank would cut rates to 2% yesterday. And there had been some feeling in the city that they might go even further and have back-to-back cuts of 1.5 points, now having cut rates by 1.5 points in November. Some people in the city thought, well, they may do the same again.
And presumably it leaves the door open for lower interest rates in the near future.
Well, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that we've got further to go with this rate cutting trend. We've seen rates come down obviously from 5% to 2% in less than 2 months really. And they're going to come down further. I mean, rates have never been this low in the entire history of the Bank of England. Well, they've been 2%, but they've never been lower than 2% in the entire history of the Bank of England. And they will be down to 1%, I think, by early next year. And they could conceivably go even lower than that. We could have rates at 0.25% or 0.5%. I mean, really uncharted water.
Will the high street banks pass these rate cuts on to consumers?
Not in full. No, I don't think they will be passed on in full. There's already been evidence yesterday afternoon, pretty quickly after the decision was announced. You've got a flurry of announcements from lenders that, and by their trade associations, that they were in no position to pass on these rate cuts in full. They were worried about savers. Some of the banks just don't have the money to support vast amounts of bank lending in any event, and they're worried about the viability of their businesses. So I don't see these rate cuts being passed on in full by any stretch of the imagination, despite what the government may say.
You mentioned savers. Isn't it a bit unfair on them, people who have been possibly more prudent than other people during the good times, and now they're being punished for it?
Savers will complain like mad about this decision, and they will say that, particularly if you're a pensioner, you spend nearly all your income, and you rely very heavily on your savings, on the interest rates you get on your savings to fund your income, that this is completely unfair. But the fact is that most of the economic evidence suggests that the impact of a rate cut on borrowers, you know, the money it frees up for them, outweighs the impact on savers. That's why the government, that's why policymakers do it, because they think that cutting interest rates actually provides a stimulus to the economy in bad times. So yes, savers do lose out. And they have every good reason to feel sore about it, but that's the way it works, unfortunately.
When will we know whether these huge rate cuts will have this stimulus effect on the economy?
Well, I think what we have to do really is take a look across the Atlantic, and there the portents are not especially hopeful. The U.S. Federal Reserve, which is the equivalent of our Bank of England, has been cutting interest rates more aggressively sooner than the Bank of England has here. They got interest rates down to 2% back in May. Now, today we are likely to see the most horrendous set of jobless figures from the US. They have something called the non-farm payrolls, which is essentially the overview of their labour market. People on Wall Street are talking about a third of a million people being taken off payrolls in November alone. I mean, that's a huge, huge number. And it just goes to show that cutting interest rates has not done the trick in the US. I mean, the economy has gone from bad to worse over the last 6 months. We've had all this, obviously, the financial turmoil, which started in September. But there's, you know, cutting rates on its own, short-term rates, has not done the trick.
Larry Elliott. I'm John Dennis. Still to come on Guardian Daily, Israeli police remove hardline Jewish settlers from a disputed house in Hebron in the West Bank.
It's quite an aggressive evacuation. I'm seeing people being dragged out, sort of four policemen dragging each person. There's quite a lot of resistance to this evacuation.
But first, 9-year-old Shannon Matthews was kidnapped, drugged and tethered to a wall by her own mother. Karen Matthews and her boyfriend Michael Donovan hoped to make money out of the sympathetic public. Prosecutors described Matthews as a proven, consummate, skillful and convincing liar. The pair were convicted yesterday at Leeds Crown Court of false imprisonment, kidnap and perverting the course of justice. The Guardian's Martin Wainwright reports from outside the court, where the policeman leading the hunt for Shannon, Detective Superintendent Andy Brennan, spoke to reporters.
On the 19th of February, Shannon Matthews was reported missing by the one person that she should have been able to trust above all others, her own mother, Karen Matthews. Karen Matthews is pure evil. She started deceiving those closest to her from the very moment that Shannon was kidnapped. Friends, neighbours and family were under the clear impression that Shannon was genuinely missing. They had no reason to believe that Shannon had been taken as part of an elaborate scam or hoax.
The hunt for Shannon Matthews and the legal proceedings following her discovery were complex and very, very costly. Hundreds of police officers in West Yorkshire were involved. Murder inquiries were temporarily stopped. The whole thing in the end cost £3,200,000. It also had an extraordinary effect on the community in Dewsbury, particularly on the Moorside estate, but in Dewsbury as a whole, and spreading elsewhere in West Yorkshire to Huddersfield, Leeds and so on, because so many people joined in trying to find the little girl, unaware that all the time it was her family who were involved in her disappearance. I spoke after the verdicts to Detective Chief Superintendent Andy Brennan, who led the inquiry and who admitted that when he first heard that Shannon had been found, his instinctive reaction was, where's the body going to be taken?
We always believed the fact that Shannon was missing to be a genuine incident, and we didn't know the circumstances surrounding why she was missing, whether she was a genuinely missing child. But as time went by, I think it was about the first week, I'd made suggestions to yourselves that I believe that she may have fallen into the wrong hands. Now, there was nothing to suggest at that point that the family were involved in any way, shape or form. We only realised it was a family member when we actually rescued Shannon Matthews from the home address of Michael Donovan. And it's now public knowledge that the comments that he made at the time that Shannon was rescued and he was arrested, he implicated Karen. We had one call from a resident up there. But the contents of that call was, there's a weirdo lives in a block of flats from 20 to 28. No suggestion that Shannon Matthews was there. No reason why the call was made other than the fact that there was a weirdo there.
Right.
When you get an instance of this nature, or a murder inquiry, we get hundreds of calls.
He talked about his feelings when he heard, to his astonishment, that the little girl had been found alive after 24 days.
Oh, it was absolutely, yeah, it stopped me in my tracks. And when I got back to Dewsbury Police Station, I wanted to physically see her for myself. I walked into the room where Shannon was. She was with Detective Constables Townsend and Kettlewell, and she was just stood there. The officers explained to Shannon who I was, and she smiled and said hello. I smiled and said hello back. And that's all that needed to be said, really, at that point. It was enough, and I just, gobsmacked, really. Because of the nature of work that I do, it's predominantly murder inquiries that I investigate. So to be involved in an investigation where we've had the opportunity of rescuing a 9-year-old child and getting us back safe and well, police work doesn't get any better than that.
The verdicts came after 5 hours deliberation by the jury of 5 women and 7 men at Leeds Crown Court. Mr. Justice McComb, just before the jury filed back in at 1 o'clock, appealed for a completely quiet reaction. He didn't want any noise in court, and there was none. As the foreman of the jury announced the verdicts, which was guilty on all three counts for each defendant, Karen Matthews and Michael Donovan stood in the dock and were completely expressionless. And that's been the case really throughout the trial, except when Karen Matthews was giving evidence, when she sobbed, burst into tears, and was accused repeatedly by both the prosecuting counsel, Julian Goose QC, and by Alan Conrad QC, who is a counsel for Michael Donovan, of being a consummate liar and play actor, able to turn and turn off her tears like a tap. But when the verdict actually came, and before she was taken down to go off to Newhall Prison awaiting sentence, and Michael Donovan going off to Armley awaiting sentence, there was no expression whatever on that familiar face, those familiar faces.
Martin Wainwright at Leeds Crown Court. Israeli riot police moved in to forcibly remove hundreds of militant Jewish settlers from a disputed house in the West Bank city of Hebron yesterday. The house had become a symbol for settler groups since around a dozen families occupied it in March last year. Rory McCarthy reports from the scene.
I've been standing at this house all day, and just in the last half an hour, a large number of Israeli border police, riot police, have stormed into the building and have been dragging the settlers out. This is a building that the settlers have occupied more than a year and a half. They claimed they bought it legally, but 3 weeks ago the Israeli Supreme Court ordered the building to be evacuated. The settlers have resisted, they've stayed on in their house, and then today the police have moved in to take them out.
And what are the implications of this?
Well, over the last few months, the settler movement in the occupied West Bank has been getting increasingly vocal, and this really became their cause célèbre. They've occupied this house, which they claim they legally bought. It's three stories high. It's got 15 families in it and dozens of other supporters. And so these are the people being taken out today. It's quite an aggressive evacuation. I'm seeing people being dragged out, sort of four policemen dragging each person. There's quite a lot of resistance to this evacuation today. But essentially it means that the government has decided that this cannot go any longer. This one house, it cannot go on any longer, and that the settlers must be forced out.
And the settlers have been supported by activists from outside the area.
Yeah, there are 15 families who've been living here, but there are dozens, if not hundreds, of other settlers who've come in from across the rest of the West Bank to join them, and obviously to try and make any evacuation like this more difficult for the police. There are more than 400,000 Jewish settlers living in East Jerusalem in the occupied West Bank. This particular house is in Hebron, very close to Kiryat Arba, which is a major settlement that's been in Hebron for 30 years. And this particular house is the latest in their cause.
What's going to happen to these settlers?
Well, I mean, the settlers are taken out of the house now, and presumably they will go and be living in other settlements elsewhere in the West Bank until they can somehow try to find a way to come back to this particular building.
Rory McCarthy in Hebron. Zimbabwe has declared a national emergency over the cholera epidemic that has forced hundreds to flee the country. Chris McGreal is in Harare for The Guardian. Chris, the authorities have previously said that the cholera outbreak was under control. Why have the government now declared a state of emergency?
I think because almost everybody else has recognised that it's way beyond its control. The cutting off of water to the capital, Harare, has left a lot of people extremely desperate. The government has realised that without some kind of international assistance, they're not only not going to be able to reverse this, but the death toll is likely to escalate. Officially 500 dead, but nearly half of those have been recorded in Harare. Final death toll may run into the thousands. We've also got 12,000 recorded cases of cholera. So that gives you some idea of the sheer scale of it.
Could you give us some idea of how basic services are unable to function in Zimbabwe at the moment?
It's not just the cholera. It's also that major hospitals, even here in Harare, the country's biggest hospital, have been closed now for several weeks. This is in part because doctors and nurses haven't been paid and they simply stopped going to work, but also the lack of water, the lack of sanitation has an impact on hospitals and their ability to function. They're not getting the drugs they need often to be able to treat patients or to do operations. And see that across the board in a number of areas. One of the reasons we had the cholera epidemic at all is because of the sewage system has, in many parts of the country, failed and hasn't been repaired. So you now have open sewage running through particularly the more crowded townships around Harare and other places. You also have clinics that are unable to, in those areas, treat children for infections, and that leads in itself to the further spread of disease.
What effect will the state of emergency have on the situation?
Largely done for effect to attract foreign attention. I think that, as you know, this government is regarded as something of a pariah government, particularly in the West, and most foreign governments have been reluctant to give aid. I think that by standing up, calling it a national emergency, saying it's about health, that opens the way for foreign aid. Already Britain's announced it will help. The European Union says it will help. It gives foreign governments a way in.
Chris McGreal. Now, there's a special edition of our Music Weekly podcast this week featuring the great singer Robert Wyatt. He's just had his entire back catalogue reissued by Domino Records. Here he is discussing reality TV talent shows.
I admire all the kids who get on these sort of competition programmes to be, X Factor and all that stuff. I admire, but I think it's a shame that they're just presented with this idea of massive success or total failure, when in fact you can live like a cottage industry. You can do stuff that other people will listen to, and it doesn't have to conquer the world, Just find enough people out there who will listen to you. And if you want to get rich and famous, well, then you are, that is a constraint, but that's your own fault. If you stick with what you do and develop it, with any luck, you will find people who will sort of get interested in it.
Robert Wyatt, and you can listen to the rest of that interview at guardian.co.uk/music. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.